Welcome back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. We continue our series on injustice and the appeal of Jerry Chambers. The law is supposed to put people on notice of what not to do. It is supposed to make sense. Yet the Georgia Supreme Court sometimes reads the law in inexplicable ways. In the case of Jerry Chambers, the court reversed decades of prior cases to reach a conclusion that makes no sense. I sat down with the lead trial prosecutor, Matt Braden, to figure out how this could happen and what it means for all of us. And welcome back. I know you've missed Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm really very excited because we are covering this case on Jerry Chambers, which was very important in Savannah. This case had a lot of the community very upset, so many aspects. And I get to today talk to the lead attorney on this case, which was Matt Braden, Noah Abrams, who also tried this case, did a lot of the gang work on it, was unable to join us. So we're going to talk about him, but not with him. but Matt, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Like I've been here once or twice before, but I'm Matt Braden. I've been an assistant district attorney now going on 21 years. Some would say a dinosaur at this point.
I've been a dinosaur a while. I kind of know that feeling. So 21 years as a prosecutor, you've been all over the place, right?
So 8 years down in Daugherty County in Albany, Georgia, home of the Miller Lite factory and free beer.
And all sorts of bizarre crime.
Yes. I left there, went to Savannah, where I worked with you for almost 10 years until...
Almost 10 years. Dang. Wow.
I came to the realization that elections have consequences. And
they tell you that on TV. I'm just telling
they
you.
They do. And I was shipped off to Effingham to hide in an attic like Anne Frank until I can come back home, which will probably be never.
So someone's going to ship you off to a camp somewhere? Is that what you're worried about? I don't think that's going to happen. I have a feeling that you are... safe for the moment, at least. So you have been doing all manner of felony prosecution all that time, right?
Yeah. Savannah was mainly major crimes. So complex gang cases, murders, armed robberies. Now, same thing with the added fun of sexual assaults.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. Effingham. We could go on and on about Effingham. Yes. And that is not what this show is going to be about today. Because I want to talk about, I think it really is important to also note your experience. You know, there are two things that you teach on regularly. Well, three main things. Those being gangs, visual presentation, in the courtroom, and on just generally how to present a case so that a jury gets it. And this case that brought us here is Jerry Chambers. So much work that you've put in over the years and that you teach on and all that kind of stuff came together in this case. And I do want to get to it substantively, but I also want to talk about the things that can just tear that apart with very little thought. So Jerry Chambers was recently, and I'm here because it was recently reversed on appeal.
Yes.
Which I don't know, which I was deeply upset by, and I didn't even try this case. Is that fair to, yeah.
I was very upset. I think this is one of those decisions that is incomprehensible. It's when you look at the facts, and then you look at the decision that came down from the appellate court, it really defies reason and common sense. That anybody looking at this objectively with just the understanding of a normal human being would not understand this ruling and why it is the way that it is.
Right. And so Jerry Chambers, and I do, like I said, I want to talk about the facts of it and the actual law involved, but it turned on the opinion, turned on how the statute, fleeing and eluding, which was the underlying felony for a felony murder conviction in this case, how that statute is to be read. So basically, it deals with dictionary definitions, right?
Yeah.
And we've seen the appellate courts do this before, and that's, I kind of want to mention those things to get them out of the way so that we can talk about Jerry Chambers. But we have seen particularly the Georgia Supreme Court, do some things that defy logic, or at least defy common sense, when looking at statutes. Well, the first one that came to mind when I saw this opinion was possession of a firearm by convicted felon. Do you remember that there was some weirdness with that statute some time back? Yes,
and to lump it together, possession of child pornography. So what are...
Because those are similar.
Yes. In the sense that they are possessing things that at some point the person shouldn't have, a firearm by a convicted felon, then no one should have child pornography. But our appellate courts, in their infinite wisdom, decided that counting doesn't matter. And so our statutes say if you possess a firearm and you're a convicted felon, at that point, you're, it's a 5-year penalty. Same thing for every image of child porn was a 10-year penalty. And they came back and said, well, the statute doesn't specifically say a number, so we're going to say that it all equals one. So you could have 27 firearms and you get the same penalty as somebody who has one. You could have 4,000 images of child pornography and you get the same penalty as somebody who has one.
Right. What it led to, and of course, both of those statutes were then reformulated by the legislature so that they say possession of any firearm, which apparently is different than a firearm. Most of us understand a to mean singular, but I really am not sure where that came from with our appellate courts, but they changed it to any. And I think that that has corrected at least that unit of prosecution. And I'm doing air quotes, which is something I despise. But that was what they were talking about.
It is. I think the issue is, and I'm not commenting on any individual, I'm not getting down on our appellate judges or anything, but I think the issue is that the individuals who end up on our appellate courts, for the vast majority of them, have been lifelong legal experts and professors or civil attorneys who don't actually do courtroom type work. And so they have never been involved in the trenches. They've never been involved in the nuts and bolts of you know, how the sausage is made. And so they are looking at it from up on high, but having never experienced it. And so when they come out with these decisions, what they're used to are these esoteric debates that you have with each other, where we start talking about, you know, well, what happened when the law changed in 1935, and then in 1970, this happened. And none of that matters to the average person.
All right. What was the definition of is back in 1776 really is not incredibly relevant to, you know, you go out and you're a convicted felon and you possess, you know, an arsenal of firearms. You expect that you're going to get popped for all of them.
Right.
But hey, you get your lucky day of, you know, I'm only going to get sentenced for one. And that, obviously, the legislature did not agree that that was what their intention was. And in fact, we've gotten to a point in some of these opinions where when you argue legislative intent from the actual minutes of the legislature or whatever, the appellate courts will say that that doesn't matter, which I find unnerving. If you were a legislator and you worked on something for as long as you worked on to get the language right, for them to say, nah.
Yeah, it makes no sense, because they argue, they'll write in their opinions, this is what we believe the legislative intent was, but they won't consider what the legislator actually said their intent was.
Yeah.
You know?
It's wild. And so, you know, it is a very unnerving world that you live in when, you know, things will turn on those kinds of, you know, just the definition of A. Okay. But we've also seen it like in other contexts that like are, again, common sense contexts. There's a case, and I know that you had this, there were a couple, I think, out of Chatham that had this element to it where you've got somebody who gets robbed or hijacked, their motor vehicle gets hijacked. And you don't know if it's the same person that took the car, but they get caught with the car and they get charged with, initially at least, theft by receiving stolen property. And I guess we need to talk about what that is.
Sure. So, well, I can give you the example, which was, I tried a case where a local TV personality, I won't use her name, was getting out of a car at her apartment or rental that she had in downtown Savannah. And the defendant came up walking down the street. He kind of just said, "Hey, what's up?" She acknowledged him, which was a mistake at that time of night. And he walks over to the car and just starts trying to talk to her, and then starts hitting on her. And it becomes more and more sexual to where she just doesn't feel comfortable.
Well, it's aggressive too.
Yes.
If I remember right. Yeah.
He's standing very close to the door. He won't let her open the door. And eventually she does get the door open. At that point, he yanks her purse. He starts pushing. He tries to get her into the car, and she gets behind the car somehow. And he jumps into the driver's seat. He backs the car up, pins her against a tree, and then drives away.
That being a Savannah crepe myrtle tree, in case you're wondering.
It is. We'll discuss why that became important in a second. But he drives away. He gets caught within 2 days. He is seen on 16, which is the interstate, heading out of Savannah by Georgia State Patrol. They chase him. He ends up wrecking his car. He jumps out and actually dives right over the hood of the Georgia State Patrol car, which is great because he does a full-on dive and looks directly at the camera as he does it. So we get a great shot of his face. And then he runs off into the woods where they send in the dogs and end up getting him back outside. So we go to trial. And this case was actually indicted by a former ADA who you probably know better than me, Ann Elmore.
Ann Elmore. Ann was a prosecutor for 20-some odd years, so yeah.
And so I got saddled with trying the case. Great case as far as the defendant's concerned. The two issues I had were we had an unlikable victim because she just felt like she was going to say whatever she wanted to say, even things that I would tell her, listen, your feelings towards people of a certain race and things like that, now that you've been robbed, just aren't important for a Savannah jury. But she just had to get those things out for a jury. She had to say what she wanted to say, and it was cringeworthy.
Oh, that's awful.
The other thing, as you mentioned, the tree, it was indicted oddly specific. When you put things in an indictment, you have to prove them to a jury. And Ann indicted it as backing her up and pinning her against a crepe myrtle. And I got there, like,
why would you just say tree?
I got no clue what kind of fucking tree this was. Like, I'm sitting there, I'm like, I don't know. You know, I've got the detective on the stand, and I already know the defense is going to raise this issue of we didn't prove what it was. I'm like, it's a tree. It doesn't matter. And I asked the guy, I said, hey, just by chance, man, I had been in the office maybe 3 months. Like, do you know what kind of tree this was? And he just dead looks at me and goes, you know, my family used to own a nursery that I worked at for years as a teenager. That was a crepe myrtle. I was like, yes.
I want to point out just one like added thing that I'm so glad that you broke the curse barrier so I can say fuck as much as I want to now. Thank you.
No problem. So this dude gets convicted very quickly and gets convicted of everything. He gets convicted of armed robbery because he used a firearm to rob her. And takes her car.
Well, he also took her purse, so those were separate, right?
Correct. Yeah. He also was charged and convicted of theft by receiving stolen property for having the car 2 days later. And you think receiving means you get it from somebody, but the statute says receiving is you receive it or you can retain it from somebody else. So, you know, you can just have something that's stolen and keep it. So
this sounds like retaining to me. Call me crazy. Because, you know, it is a definitely incriminating thing that you could very easily, like, dump on the side of the road. I mean, it's not like you have to retain it. So why would that be, you know, that should be criminal in and of itself. You're retaining it for your own use. Right. That's how the statute reads. Or at least that's how the statute reads to most of us.
So, you know, fast forward a couple years. He goes up through the appeal process. The Court of Appeals denies his appeal. His grounds for his appeal is the theft by receiving statute and the armed robbery statute are mutually exclusive, that you cannot both be the person who takes something and the person who receives or retains it. You've got to be one
factually,
or the
other. Although, you definitely can. There's no question about it because it happened here.
So, Court of Appeals denies it. We go up for oral argument on the Supreme Court, and I will say that oral argument before the Supreme Court is one of the top 10 things in my legal career that is the most painful and horrible thing I've ever had to do.
It's gotten a lot worse. So I've done oral argument a fair bit, and I know you have too. Back in the day, probably in even up through late 20-aughts, it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was nerve-wracking because you're standing there, you're by yourself, it's not a jury, you can't pace around, you can't do your visual things. I mean, you can do a little bit now. And honestly, Jerry Chambers would have been a case to do that, but that's a separate issue. This experience, and you just have to sit there and hope to God you remember every citation that ever came up. Now it is almost antagonistic.
It is.
And there's just a very competitive sense. You get that feeling amongst the justices and with that they're competing with each other and with you. And it's kind of like, we're all doing different things here, right?
I got the feeling that you get, there appeared to be three types of justices on the Supreme Court that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
There were the, we're here to do the job justices, that they're going to come in and they're going to ask their one or two questions that they want to know if you can answer. And they want somebody to say it so that it backs up their opinion. And they may also come up with a legitimate question, such as in Jerry Chambers, we'll talk about who was wearing what, right? That's a question that they want answered because maybe it's not in the brief. Then you have the justices who are, they're just there. They sit there. They will not ask a question. They're going to pay attention. Who knows what they're going to do, but they're not active, right? That's your Clarence Thomas, right? Who never asked a question for like, 15, 16 years.
Yeah.
And then you have the I'm smarter than everybody else in the room justice, who their questions aren't actually designed to get to what's happening in the case. It's designed to ask you a question that you don't know the answer to and can't answer because why would you think of it? I went up for one of my very first oral argument, and a civil case was being argued before me. And it was a case dealing with some sort of civil damages. And one of the questions asked by then Chief Justice Navius was to this civil attorney who had to be 26 years old, right? Was, can you explain to me how the change in this statute in 1936 affected this case?
And this poor child.
Yeah, she just sat there like a deer in headlights. I would have too, because I'm like, I don't know. The statute changed in 1980 and 1970 and 1950. So why would I ever think to look at what the change in 1936 was? But he looked at it and he wanted to ask a question that nobody would know the answer to, because now I'm the smartest person in the room and I can argue with the other justices who are like me.
Well, and and the numbers of those have increased. So you see that competition. One of the things that, just to clarify what happens with oral argument, that arguments are timed. So I have seen the justices now spend like my time to be making oral argument, arguing with each other or like giving a long scenario. And it's like, I only get to talk about my case for like, you know, much less time than I normally right. would have. And I would add too, like you do back in the day, you'd have a justice. I remember like Kevin Smith, I was second chairing that oral argument. And they're just like, tell me your best case for this. That makes sense to me, right? Because you're writing your opinion. And then if they want to argue against that, they know where the holes are, right? That makes sense to me. If you're getting an argument or you're getting something from the justices that's like, you know, just a complete side quest, you don't even know what you're talking about anymore. And you can make a concession you don't want to.
Right.
And you see that happen more and more and more. And we're going to talk about that possibly with Jerry Chambers as well.
But going back to our, which is, sorry. I got a little sidetracked, is yeah. that, so on appeal, I do this oral argument. It's a Zoom oral argument because it's during COVID. And
that was horrible.
Yes. So their question to me was, listen, there's case law that says you cannot be both the person who takes something and the person who receives it, which makes perfect sense to me. It's one or the other. Either you took it or somebody else gave it to you. And so they said those things are what's called a mutually exclusive verdict. You can't have both. Therefore, one of them has to go away. We always err on the side of the defendant and kick the greater charge. It is what it is. My response when they said this was, well, the statute says retains. And I'm not saying he took it and then received it. I'm saying he took it and then kept it.
Right.
And right. We had a huge argument with this. And I've never wanted to curse more in an oral argument than that, because we're going back to, it was Justice Namias. And he asked me, you know, the law says this. And I said, it does. I said, but common sense is that a person can take something and retain it. I can go right now to a store and buy something, right? I don't care what it is. I can buy a microwave. And I put it in my house, and every day after that, I have retained it. Mm-hmm. So it makes no sense to me that we're saying it is mutually exclusive, that somebody can't both take something and keep it. And he looked at me, and his response was, well, now you're making things up. And I wanted to say, yeah, but so are you. That's what this process is. All of these laws are made up. So right. Why can't they just make sense?
Well, right, and why can't we, and it's actually a legal precept that you are supposed to give meaning to all aspects of the law so that they make sense. And it's actually something that Justice LaGrua mentioned in her dissent in Jerry Chambers. But again, we're going to get to Jerry Chambers. But you know, that whole thing, so they end up reversing this armed robbery.
Yeah.
And, you know, what did you end up doing with that case? Did you try it again?
No, he was already. So, as you said, there was a second armed robbery.
Right.
With the purse. There was also a hijacking a motor vehicle.
Right.
And he got life on those charges. So there was no point in retrying him. He didn't win anything, but the decision made no sense. And I think that's the issue that I'm seeing. And I think you might be seeing with some of these decisions is that they're not. One, common sense decisions, right? We're not applying common meaning to words. And the goal of the law is so that people can understand it, right? You shouldn't need a law degree to understand what is illegal. You might need a law degree to try a case and understand the rules of evidence and things like that. But to know what a crime is, everybody should be able to get what that is. And it's just getting ever more complicated.
Well, right. The idea, you know, like people's common understanding is I can't take something and keep it forever. You know what I mean? Like, I can't steal your stuff and keep it forever and like live in your house or whatever. I mean, it's just like, you can't, that would be retaining to me. So, I mean, I just don't understand why we have things that the common person, if you went around and asked people on the street, what does this mean? They should be able to understand it, right?
It's this idea that everything has to be a legal debate, that we're making it way more complicated than it is. And it seems like we are showing more and more deference to criminal defendants than victims of crime, to the point of we are now, as I see it, the courts actively trying to protect defendants from the evidence of their own crimes.
Well, right. And so I think Jerry Chambers is a good example of that. I want to talk about that in just a second. But when you're talking about, there are, again, legal concepts like, you know, hey, you know, we give deference to the defendant. Like, we don't want to convict a person who's not guilty, you know, those kinds of things. And we don't. But Jerry Chambers is getting away with something based on this opinion by the Georgia Supreme Court.
Yes.
Tell us first. And I'm, you know, we've had an episode about the investigation. I still think it's worth reiterating what this case is about.
Yeah. So in essence, it began as a gang case that started, you know, years before in Savannah. And when we talk about investigating these cases, he's not here and I can't be on with him later or before, depending on which order this goes in. You're in charge of that.
I am. But I guess
you know, Rob Santoro, who is probably the best investigator I've ever worked with. Most thorough,
Absolutely.
Number one investigator. But he, when we talk about these cases and what it was, is we had a number of gangs, and like gangs do, these are neighborhood based gangs. So not your national gangs. Your national gangs would be your Bloods, your Crips, and your various sets of Bloods, right? Like Sex, Money, Murder, which changed into G-Shine, things like that. So we get those East Coast gangs here. So Sex, Money, Murder started up in New York, worked its way down the East Coast, rebranded to G-Shine, because Sex, Money, Murder just sounds super violent.
It's like not false advertising, but it's a little too obvious.
Right. But we get those East Coast Bloods coming down here, and you get various sets that are authorized and blessed sets from the gang. But you also get these neighborhood-based gangs, which are a group of high school kids want to start calling themselves Bloods. And they come up with a set of Bloods, and they start adopting the same things that the national Bloods do. But because we don't have, I would say, those very organized national Bloods that are like, listen, you're not going to say you're a Blood if you're not. You get these national or these neighborhood-based gangs. And so that's what we got here, which was a group called OTM, Only the Mob, and a group called 1100.
Because they were from?
An 1100 block. So yep. They go to their street. And they started from like two other gangs, and it was so dumb. Like,
right, there was OTF before OTM. Right. I mean, yeah.
There was a gang that became OTF, and then somebody like stole a gun from somebody else, and they had this big fight about it, and then you get OTM, and you get 1100, and you get OTF is still there, and whatever. And they're smaller gangs, but the issue with these neighborhood-based gangs is they're often more violent than your national-based gangs sometimes, because your national-based gangs, right, your GDs, they want to make money. Now, they're going to be violent. They're going to sell drugs. They're going to use violence when they have to. But their ultimate goal is, we are making money and increasing our territory to make money, to sell drugs in, to do run prostitution, human traffic, things like that.
They're more disciplined, so they have, right. They have a lot of internal discipline, which yes. You don't see with some of these local gangs.
Correct. And local gangs, right, you're a startup, right? You've got to increase your territory and your name, right? Like, you can't...
Yes, we're talking about this in business terms.
You are. Fucked up. I'm sorry. You're a small startup organization going against Walmart. So you got to get out there, and you got to have that guerrilla marketing. And that's what they do. And the way you do that is to be as violent as possible. And there were just shootings every other day, sometimes every day. And so what led us in Jerry Chambers is we had a shooting in City Market, which is the downtown area of Savannah. It's the tourist spot where everybody goes. And this was dead center of City Market on video. Jerry Chambers pulls up in a vehicle with other individuals, Gabriel Magulius, and my brain is now drawing a blank on the third person in the car.
Don't ask me, because I didn't try this case. I did memorize the names other than Jerry.
The car belonged to Gabriel's parents. They owned a bakery. He was adopted, and they let him take the car. The family was very close to Jerry as well. Jerry would come over to the house. And what you see is Jerry Chambers is driving. They pull up next to a set of rival gang members that are sitting at the corner of kind of the main intersection in City Market.
Is it like Jefferson and Barnard or something? Yes. Or something like that? Yeah.
I think so. And
Jefferson.
Actually, Barnard. I should say it's one over. And so you see a hand come out, and you don't really get to see the gunshots because the camera's a little farther away, but you see people scattering.
The reaction to the gunshots.
Right. A number of people are shot. Jerry speeds off. So he hits Bay Street, hangs.
Now, wait, what day of the week? What day is this?
This was July 4th.
So this is okay. And to clarify, Savannah has a couple of major festival type weekends. St. Patrick's Day, big one coming up here. You're going to have a lot of people gathering. MLK Day depends on the weather. But you will have big gatherings. July 4th is huge.
Right.
So you've got a lot of people downtown. Right.
So we're going to beer too.
It's time. Dang, we may have to break into something else.
Now, Jerry pulls off. He hangs a left on Bay Street and heads out of town towards the ports. And he gets to an area town, and I don't know if he just didn't know where he was going or he didn't know what to do. Like, he was trying to get away so fast, he wasn't paying attention to where he was going. And so he starts to loop around to come back into this area of Savannah to head to where he lives.
Where was it that he was living? Do you remember?
I don't. Mm-hmm. Now, he gets lit up by two Savannah officers.
Let's clarify what you mean by lit up there.
So they're driving a marked patrol car, lights and sirens. They are in Savannah police uniforms. Their uniforms are in that day are 5'11 tactical pants and the shirts that have a big yellow Savannah badge and then big letters on the back that say police.
Yeah, that are reflective because, yes, you know, it's 4th of July. Those tactical uniforms are critical for these big festival situations, right, so that everybody knows that when I tell you to stop doing shit, I'm a cop.
Well, and you're walking around all night. Nobody's walking around in a uniform with long sleeves and, you know, pants. That you're wearing the more, hey, I'm walking around all night type stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, so they hit the lights, sirens. Jerry flees. He's coming back into Savannah, going around 100 miles an hour. As they're coming back into the crowded area of Bay Street, you hear the two officers in the car call off the chase and say, hey, we're backing off. We're coming in. There's lots of pedestrians here.
Right.
We don't want anybody to get hurt. Maybe he'll slow down. He does not.
So 100 miles an hour, he is coming into, and fireworks have just finished, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so people are coming, walking across the street. So Bay Street runs in between River Street, where all the fireworks.
The big party thing. Right. Yeah. On the
river. Party time, fireworks, everybody's down there. And then downtown Savannah, which is where all your restaurants, stores,
City Market,
all that stuff is.
All
yeah.
Of that.
Yeah. And so people are coming across the street. He's hauling ass at 100 miles an hour. And you see on an officer's dash cam that this officer is running, and there's a 30-second delay on body-worn cameras. I said dash cam. You see the dash cam of the officers chasing him into Savannah. Then it picks up on a body-worn camera of an officer running down the street, and you just see him waving his hand and yelling, trying to get people out of the way and across the street.
Because they see it coming.
Right.
And a lot of people did not.
Right. And there were two people that one of them made it, one did not. And you see very clearly on the body cam that Jerry hits pedestrian crossing the street, hits him at close to 100 miles an hour. And it is probably one of the top five most gruesome things I've ever seen, because he hits him so fast that it just cuts him in half at the waist. And half of his body ends up 150 yards down the street.
Well, right. And part of him, you see it fly up in the air.
Right.
I was not involved in the trial of this case. I know you and Jameson Dowd put in an absurd amount of work splicing all these videos right together. And we're going to talk about that in more detail. But I remember seeing that. I'm never getting that vision out of my head.
Right.
Ever. Ever.
And after hitting the victim, Jerry loses control. Jerry Chambers loses control of the vehicle. He hits a light post right in front of five guys. And there was actually two younger people right behind that light post. And had that light post not been there, they would have
been dead.
They would have gone.
Yeah.
But that light post basically hits dead center of the car, and it goes all the way in to the driver's compartment. It ends up killing the passenger and the rear seat passenger in the car, and Jerry Chambers perfectly fine.
And gripping the steering wheel.
Almost no injuries. He's got a little injury to his wrist, a cut on his arm.
And this is caught on body worn camera.
Yes.
Which, from a prosecutor's perspective, is, well, that's great. Sort of.
Yeah, I mean, you tell a jury, listen, you don't have to believe a word I say. We're going to sit here and watch it all together. You just have to believe what you see, because we're all going to see Jerry Chambers commit each and every one of these crimes.
And so I want to zoom out a little bit. Let me let you finish one more thing. So you get this case, you get involved in this case, possibly because you're incredibly adept at gang stuff and visual presentation. You and Noah were working this, and he'd been working OTM 1100 for a while, right?
Noah had worked for a very long time at the counter narcotics team.
Yeah.
Being a drug prosecutor, high level drug prosecutor, and of course, gangs deal drugs.
Right.
So he had a very good understanding of these individuals and their past crimes as well.
Right. And they were all interrelated. They've been shooting at each other for, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of violence going back and forth, and like drug rips and all of those things have been going on for months. And even months after this. But from an impact on the community standpoint, and you've had a bunch of high profile cases, where would this rank for you?
I mean, I'd say it's in the top five, if not top three.
Yeah.
I mean, the individual that was killed was a very well-known member of the community. He
loved.
Yes, he worked at a local restaurant. People knew him. He was very, very involved in the LGBTQ community.
He was also doing charitable stuff too.
Yes, so he was somebody who, when it came out who the victim was, when they had the funeral, this was another one where, you know, hundreds of people were involved in mourning this guy.
Well, and my understanding too is that he had been protecting someone else as they were crossing the street.
You could see him, he was with a female, and you could see him pushing her out of the way before he was hit.
Heartbreaking. I mean, I'm not a super emotional person, other than having a completely inappropriate sense of humor and being angry. This is horrible. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible case. And there were a lot of community members that came out about this case. Am I right about that?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Now, we have gang members that are killed too, though.
Two.
Did you have, were they helpful at all? The families?
No.
I'm always surprised by that. So that's why I'm asking.
The third individual's family never communicated with us. We reached out to them. They wouldn't communicate. I remember Gabriel Magulius's name specifically because his family was very, very involved in the case.
Involved in what way?
Involved in supporting Jerry Chambers. His mother went to see Jerry Chambers at the jail, was telling him that this was not his fault, that everyone was out to get him, that, you know, this was the officer's fault, that they should not have been chasing him.
Whoa.
You know, and so they were.
You shoot at people and you should have impunity to shoot at people in a crowded area like City Market?
We just let them go. The police should have let him go.
Wow. And they broke off, too. They also broke off the chase.
They
it
did.
Was really not.
Yeah, there was no reason for him to be going 100 miles an hour because the police were not even behind him at the time. They were, I would say, 700-800 yards or so behind him. They and slowing down.
Right. Wow. So this case comes up. How many officers would you say were on scene?
You had two in the vehicle. You had four, I believe, that responded to the, or four or more that responded to the initial shooting. You had two or three that were running down the street, waving people by. You had the three officers that were at the crash scene that ran up to the vehicle to where Jerry Chambers was. And I mean, and if you want to just add everybody who was there and saw something, every officer that was working downtown that night basically was involved in this in some way, shape, or form.
Well, and you have countless civilians that
right.
You know, we're never even going to know who a core of those people might have been. How do you go about preparing a case like this?
Well, we had a good team at the time in Savannah. So we started with Noah and myself meeting with a number of detectives at Savannah Police Department. We plotted out exactly who we were going to charge and with what, because you got to remember, this was related to, I want to say, 5 or 6 shootings that we could tie to it leading up to it. And so all of those were indicted as well. And so we came up with a plan of who we were going to charge with what, how we were going to prove the existence of this gang. And then it became...
That's not a simple thing. Just you're having no. tried a gang case with you, it is not a simple thing for proving that someone's in a gang.
No, you have a number of gang member interviews you're going to have to go through, hundreds of thousands of pages of social media.
Yeah.
And videos to watch, and Instagram videos and posts, and Facebook posts and videos, and cell phone extractions. It's just the amount of data that you have to consume and then find a way to condense into a relatable story for a jury, right? Because you have to take something that took you 6 months to digest and cram it into 2.5 days.
And you have, I've mentioned earlier, you actually teach on how to do this.
Yes.
What is your approach?
My view is our jurors have changed over my career and probably definitely over your career.
For sure.
You know, right. I mean, when you started, people would go into the courtroom and you would probably have to use a whiteboard. You'd have to have the easel and put a picture on there.
Right. For visual stuff. You're so funny. I just talk and I'm good. But we had pictures. But reality is that, and you know, when you're trying a bunch of cases back to back, we didn't have video very often at all.
Right.
And when we did have video, getting it to play on anything that you had was like almost an impossibility because there was no uniformity at all.
When I started, there was almost no video.
It was VHS.
I got to skip the VHS era. We had CDs.
No.
But the majority of our photos were printed and we would put them on an Elmo.
Yep.
You know, so there
we didn't even have Elmo in the beginning. Yeah. Elmo was a luxury. What are you talking about? You walk up and down, it's like, here's a picture.
But our jurors now are used to watching Dateline. They're used to watching true crime. They're used to listening to podcasts like this. They're used to, this is how they retain information. And we as prosecutors have to realize that, one, our jurors are getting younger and younger than us. You know, and I've hit that.
And technologically adept. Right? Oh, my God.
I've hit that age where, like I used to say, you know, when I still don't put 19 and 20-year-olds on my jury, but 26, 27, yeah. And these people are, you know, now 20 years or more younger than me. And their views are different, and the way that they gather information, right? I didn't grow up with Dateline. I didn't grow up with the internet and podcasts. Those things didn't exist. You had to read a book, you know?
Yeah, and you know, the thing about it, the breadth of consumption out there, like podcasts or whatever, you know, things are like, this is kind of a niche podcast. There are some that have like much broader audiences. There are, but there isn't like a common thread. You know, not everybody listens to the same stuff. You know, it's like, oh, that's boring. I'm going to go, you know, this was not entertaining to me, like a TikTok for like 14 seconds. So they move on to the next thing.
Don't sell yourself short as being niche. Remember, you're a neighborhood-based gang. Guerrilla marketing and violence will get you everywhere.
I clearly haven't been trying hard enough. I need to get some of the weaponry that
get
the sound has
bat.
Around here.
Go find a rival podcaster.
Hey. We've got like a whole arsenal of shit in the attic right now.
Now,
so you never know.
But we have to realize how our jurors take information. And so you watch, or anybody watches an episode of Dateline, and how's it begin? It begins with something that grabs your attention. It is very visual, right? There's video, there's audio. And within the first 30 seconds of that episode, that intro, they tell you the story of what happened without telling you what happened, right? So you get an idea of who the victim is, probably how the victim was killed. And in your own mind, you're already making your assumptions. You're going, you know what? Husband did it. I guarantee you the husband killed her. It's who did it.
Yep.
And as the information comes out, and it comes out in a very visual way because it's mostly television, is you are confirming that opinion that you came up with right away. You're like, see, I told you it was the husband. And then they throw something else out there. You're like, maybe it wasn't. And you go, oh, no, see, it wasn't him. They were just leading me off track. You're like, nope, told you it was the husband.
Right, that confirmation bias. And right. You know, again, we are dealing with a society that has been fed a lot of true crime, like you said, or also this whole you know, wrongful conviction narrative, too. So you have to make sure that everything you've got can be corroborated by something else, and something else that can't really be argued with, like, right. like cell phone data or social media or whatever. Like, you have to make sure that you nail down everything.
So my view is, I want to get up in opening statements, and I want to give the jury almost everything that they are going to see. I want them to understand exactly how the case is going to play out for a couple of reasons. One, I want them to see it and understand it. And then when it comes out, go, that guy was telling me the truth. Everything he said came out. Also, these cases are way more complicated with the amount of video, social media, and they just take longer sometimes. And you just you lose the attention span of jurors on day 2.5, 3, 4. And so I want them to know when they're really going to need to pay attention.
Right.
I want them ready to listen for things that I have told them about. And then I want them to start understanding the case. And then I also want to destroy everything the defense is going to do. If your defense is alibi, well, I want to get up an opening and I want to say, we've got cell phone records that put this defendant there. And I want to show the jury the cell mapping
stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when the defense attorney gets up and says he wasn't there, their response is, bullshit, he wasn't there. I'm going to see in
right.
a day, I'm going to see the cell phone records that put him there. So why are you telling me he wasn't?
Right.
And so right off the rip, we are drawing the jury in to our story, and we have to carry that throughout. So every witness is a very visual presentation with PowerPoints, which is, if you use it right, is nonlinear. Videos.
I sometimes am winner. No, yeah, I know you make fun of me for that anyway. Go ahead.
Videos, jail calls. I make fun of you because all your slides look the same. But
man, fuck you.
They are orange. They
an
orange background, a black bar across the top, a thinner black bar that runs across the left side, and it has orange borders on
yours
the black bar.
now, I have some.
To be fair, mine and Chatham or whatever Jameson made for me.
And I didn't have people making stuff for me because I'm not special enough. Anyway, but this is, it's actually very funny for me. But I do want to make it.
Marsha.
Abundantly clear, you and someday it's going to happen. We are going to talk about Foley Pastures.
Yes.
The opening you gave in that case is the best opening I've ever seen, and you gave it twice flawlessly. And you're taking that as a compliment. You better be, because you know I don't give compliments. So, I mean, that was phenomenal. Yeah. But I did not see your opening in Jerry Chambers. What did you do?
The idea in Jerry was to not, one, hit them over the head right at the beginning. And so we brought out the gang, the history of violence. Let them understand who these defendants were as people. Because before I ever got to what they did that night, I honestly wanted this jury to understand that these defendants were not your average 19-year-old. To not feel sorry for them, to not feel sorry, and we ended up severing Jerry. So when I say them, we initially planned on trying all of these people together.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the severances and all that stuff. Go ahead.
So, but as we get to Jerry, to not feel sorry for him, that his two friends were killed in a car, that he's 19 years old, that he comes from, you know, a broken home, whatever it is, to say, like, listen, he has made choices every day in his life. You need to understand that this is somebody who at, you know, 20 some years old is a hardened criminal. And so we lead into that to the shooting in City Market, because it explains why they're, what was going on, why the police were chasing him, and why it wasn't, they weren't chasing him because I did worry that a jury would say, listen, the police shouldn't have chased him at all. It's 4th of July. But you need to understand, this wasn't a shoplifting. They weren't chasing somebody to 100 miles an hour because they stole a bike. It was because they shot multiple people. And
people were injured in that shooting, right? So it's not like you're just shooting, not that just shooting to the crowds, okay? I mean, I don't want that to sound flippant, but you hit people. It's not like a little thing.
No, you hit gang members, you hit innocent civilians. Yeah. Yes. And then we jump to, I wanted to show everything from the perspective of the cameras. And so we tracked Jerry Chambers' vehicle coming into downtown. We tracked it pulling up into the area of City Market. We watched the shooting. We actually zoomed in at the time of the shooting. And then we zoomed out and we tracked him every street he turned down following his car.
Because we had cameras.
We had cameras. Okay. When he leaves an area where there are no cameras, we switch to the dash cam. And we follow him on, I say dash cam, it actually wasn't a dash cam. It was a body-worn camera on the driver of the police car.
Oh, wow. So just so that civilians who have not dealt with law enforcement cameras, body-worn cameras are worn on the person.
Yes.
Dash cam is usually mounted on the vehicle somewhere. And frequently in anything involving traffic citations or something like that, it'll be a dash cam video that you have. Because Savannah Police Department, they were weird. They stopped having dash cams after a while. They stopped having body cams. There were a number of things that were strange about equipment. This was body cam.
I believe so. We could see everything. And then as they come into Savannah, we switch back to the overhead cameras. And you see him driving up on sidewalks, driving around people. And then we flip back to the inside of the vehicle on the dash cam. So we could hear the officers on the radio say, like, listen, we're coming into pedestrian traffic. We're backing off. And then you switch to the overhead cameras. You see Jerry Chambers coming in. And then immediately switch to a body-worn camera, the officer that shows you him hitting the pedestrian.
Some of the things, and I always find this true with body-worn camera, that are so palpable about it is you hear these officers reacting. You know, that panting when they're running to try to stop this horrific thing from happening. That, you know, oh my God, yep. That just that reaction is just, it puts you there. Yep. And so much of that, our appellate courts, and I think also our local judges on some level, don't want people to know about.
No.
So what happens in this case, what happened and why is this the norm?
So part of it is you got to know your judges. And what I was seeing is this judge and a number of judges these days, and especially our appellate court judges, feel the need to sanitize the case for the jury, in the sense of what they say is, yes, this is what this defendant did, but the photographs and video of what he did, or she did in some cases, is so violent, is so gruesome, that we can't show it to a jury because they'll want to convict this person. And to me, it makes no sense that we are at a point to say to somebody, you committed a crime that is so violent that we just can't let anybody see what you did. Because That's true. Chose to do these things. And yeah, I get that maybe you don't show 27 pictures of a decapitated body, right? Or you know what I mean?
Right.
But you might have to show one or two to describe what happened. You know, you don't get to tell the defendant and the jury, like, you just don't get to see this. But that was an issue in Chambers, because we had a victim who was severed in half. Like, those pictures were not pretty, and that's something nobody wants to see. And knowing that, what we did is I showed two photographs the entire time, and it was part the lower half of the victim's body and the upper half, but covered by a sheet.
So you never showed like autopsy pictures?
Nothing. I never showed a single autopsy photo, and I never showed a single photo to that jury of the victim's body.
Did you submit them? Did you tender them in evidence?
I did not.
So, I know that there had been a discussion, I remember talking about it, of putting some photographs into an envelope.
Right.
And tendering it that way. Did you do that or not?
We talked about that. Of, hey, we're going to tender this and say, if you want to look at it, you can. And at the end of the day, in this case, and I do agree in this case, it didn't prove anything, right? So,
because you saw it on video.
Right. And it was so bad that I just couldn't see and making the jury look at that for no reason. But there are times where you have to. And we had a long debate about whether or not we could even show the body camera of the person being hit where you can see him getting severed, even though it's from afar. You can see it.
I'm sorry.
And my argument was, listen, I'm not going to show the up-close photographs. I'm not going to make the jury look at this. But this is what he did. We're watching him commit the crime. And at the end of this video, you see him clear as day. You see Jerry Chambers behind the wheel. We have to show the jury him committing the crime, and it's so fast.
Yeah, it is stunningly fast. And remember that you even have to like kind of stop and highlight right. And things like that. The fact that you're having this argument, what context does this come up in?
It generally comes up, the first place it comes up is opening statements. Is the defense objects and says, you can't show this in opening statements because it's not in evidence yet, which is not the rule in the state of Georgia. And I understand their concern. Their concern is the jury's going to see something so gruesome right off the rip that they're done for the rest of the trial.
Yeah.
That they have made up their minds. But my view on that is, if these are things that are coming in evidence, they're going to make up their mind anyway. You know, I'm showing it to them in 20 minutes, so why can't I show it to them now? That prejudice doesn't go away later, so there's no reason to tell them, hey, we're not going to show this to you yet. But
we don't think you can handle it. But you were going to show it to you, and you can handle it. That doesn't make any sense.
And I really think the real reason the defense objects to it is because you show that to a jury, and then they have to stand up. What can they say?
Yeah.
What do you say at that point if you're defending somebody? My client
wants a trial.
Yeah, right. You have nothing you can say because we just saw him do something so horrible.
So was this, in this case, you anticipate a lot of these arguments?
Yes.
Because you've had a lot of these arguments before. Right. And I think it's still an ongoing kind of thing. With this case, how far did you sanitize this before you even got to the arguments in the courtroom?
As much as we could, right? Like I said, two photographs. You never see the victim's face. You never see his clothing. You see a sheet in one area, a sheet in another, and then an overhead view of how far apart they were. You know what's under there, which I'm going to be honest with you, to me, I think that's almost worse.
Yeah.
Because you see something gruesome and they look away and they've seen it and it's over and they don't want to see it again. And the truth is, you can only show something like that one time. If you were to show a severed body, you can't show it 5-6 times. No, you show it one time.
You can't. You know, no, everyone, well, yeah.
But they keep seeing these photographs and these sheets, and in their mind, they know what's under there and they're picturing it. I honestly thought it was worse, but We removed that from the trial. The video, we played the body camera video, but we did not display any autopsy photographs. We did not display any crime scene photographs of that area.
You put up, obviously, medical examiner and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And they just talked about it.
Right.
Okay. So all of those things you have made those decisions before you even get into the court. I mean, you still are going to get like a plethora of objections. I remember y'all had like motion hearings that went all day.
We did. And that's the thing that gets me when we have this argument of, we want a blanket rule that the state cannot use visuals. Because if you have a good prosecutor, a prosecutor who is experienced, that wants to do the right thing, well, they're not going to do the things that you don't want them to do, right?
Right.
We weren't going in and showing all of these photographs of this gruesome injury and a body, half of it pulled down 200 yards of a street. We were never going to do that for the jury.
Yeah.
And so you need to understand that the attorneys that are before you, the people that have been doing this for years, know how to do it.
Right. Right. And again, some of that is experience with the court, right? I mean, you have to have some experience with the court. But so much of that litigation is done before you can get into the trial.
Right.
Right. And editing down the video. And if I remember right, and I know I spoke with Noah about this too, I think the defense had filed like some sort of motion about like the officers' police letters weren't big enough or something like that.
That actually came up in closing arguments. So there was no motion. We go, the evidence in this case was abundantly clear. There was absolutely no doubt that he was guilty, right? So,
and didn't care. I mean, yeah, right. Again, there was just like no remorse.
No, they pulled him out of the car and he was talking about how his hand was hurt and he did not care that his friends were dead, did not care that he killed somebody, just no care in the world. One of the arguments on closing was that we did not prove that he was fleeing from police officers because they were in a marked police car with lights and sirens. But the statute says you have to prove that it's a police car with lights and sirens and it's marked police and that the officer is in uniform and wearing a badge. And you can see the body worn camera, one of the officers in the car, right? Mm-hmm. And what they're wearing. And you can see the video from other officers when, after the accident, those pursuing officers make it on scene and get out of their car. Their argument was the officer said they were on special detail. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows. They're like, we don't know what special detail means. That means they could be wearing anything they want. And they made fun of me for it. The defense did. But my argument to the jury was, because they mentioned these officers were getting off shift and were putting their equipment in the car. When they got the call of the shooting, they jumped back in the car and drove to the scene of the shooting, ended up getting in the chase. And they said, well, we don't know if they were still wearing their uniform. And my argument to the jury was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, do you think they were stripping down in the parking lot and now they're like chasing people in their underwear? They were still wearing their uniform. Well, they took their gun belt off. They took the stuff that you don't want to drive home in.
So this was an actual argument. So the reason that I am having this reaction is I watched the oral argument on this case, which is how we got to where we are. And it was unclear to me how this even got to be an issue on appeal in the context that it did, because basically the argument on appeal was that you didn't prove that they were in uniform. Typically speaking, that is something that's raised in the trial court. The trial court rules on it in the motion for new trial and, you know, it goes up on appeal, whatever. It came up not just in the trial court on the motion for new trial, but it came up at trial. You addressed it at trial. The trial judge who ruled on the motion for new trial saw all of it, which includes the video that shows the officers, the pursuing officers, getting out of the vehicle in the vests and all the stuff that says police.
And more importantly to me, the jury saw it and heard the argument. The jury are the citizens of your peers, right? A jury of your peers that is brought in to try this case heard this very argument. They heard the defense say the state didn't prove what the police were wearing. They heard me argue this is how we prove it. You know, they weren't driving around in jock straps and lingerie, pulling people over, and you see them on the video in their uniforms that say police. And the jury heard this and said, no, we believe that the state proved they were wearing their uniform. So we go up on appeal. I have left the office, as we said, elections. And so I'm up in Effingham. You're part-time in Effingham with me.
Right.
You're in... This is assigned to ADAs, who
did not try the case,
do not have the level of experience to handle an appeal of this magnitude, and from watching the oral argument, did not review the evidence.
Right. So this case, and you've already talked about it, almost everything you presented is on that video. Like, yes. Like the things that matter in this case are on that video. I've seen it. It takes, what, 6 minutes to watch this? I mean, and even with, you know, the stopping and zooming and that kind of stuff, it doesn't take an incredibly long time to watch the video that you have. Number one. Number two, videos and evidence. Number three, Jameson Dowd is still in that office and still has it. I'm 100% certain. That's the whole case.
Well, not only does Jameson Dowd still have it, and we'll get to this, I still have it.
Right. So if anybody does,
if you as the prosecutor who has to argue this says, I don't know what's on the video, I don't know. Maybe you get off your ass and you pick up the phone and you call the person who tried the case and say, hey man, how'd you prove this?
So as I try really hard, you know, because you did and I did, like you talked about the case involving the armed robbery, you end up picking up cases that were somebody else's.
Right.
When possible or when relevant, you will contact that prosecutor. Yeah. And I understand, you know, you come into an office, you have a zillion cases, there are a lot of things to do, appeals are a pain in the ass, they are, and often come up at inconvenient times. I also understand that the current office is very, very busy. They only have a few good people, blah, 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 whatever. This isn't a little case. I don't care who you are in that office right now. You have heard of Jerry Chambers, and I don't care if you're from somewhere else. It's not that hard. If you ask around the courthouse, hey, you ever heard of this Jerry Chambers case? People have heard of this case. Well, people know about it, and you get that sense of this is important. I need to make an effort.
And not only that, I don't work there anymore. If somebody were to call me and say, hey, Matt, will you come and argue this at the Supreme Court? I would have absolutely said yes.
Right. And see, that's another thing. And of course, that you can ask for help from other agencies, particularly in this kind of circumstance. Right. You would want to. But there are people who just don't want to ask for help, and they certainly don't want to ask for help from previous people, maybe. I don't know.
I think that's the issue. I think it's not wanting to ask for help. And I think it's not wanting to ask for help from people who are no longer in favor with the office.
That's just disturbing. So, go ahead.
You know, it goes up on appeal. The issues was what they were wearing, and there were two things that came up. And it was, you brought this up at the very beginning. What are the justices asked? What is your best case on point? And what is your best piece of evidence?
Right.
And the prosecutor handling the appeal was asked multiple times. One, there's a video, right? And it was Justice LaGrua, I think, who asked repeatedly because she had seen the video.
So it Justice Colvin. So that's where we're going to talk about that.
And said, hey, you're saying the officer chasing him was not in uniform displaying a badge. Can we see that officer in the video?
And the response was, I don't know what that officer looks like. And it's not in the transcript. So I feel like if you only look at a written transcript of a case that is entirely on video, you're not going to understand the case really at all. There is always going to be this argument of, oh, you should stop and give a number on the video and that kind of stuff. In the questioning that happened at oral argument, Justice Colvin had clearly seen the video as well. And part of what I find disturbing about this opinion, Justice LaGrua wrote a dissent that is extremely detailed and talks about specific things that are on the video, including you can see the officers and they're in uniform. Like, why? Because what this was reversed on was that, and this argument is so absurd to me, was that you have to be both in this marked police vehicle and the officer has to be in uniform. There is a plethora of case law out there dealing with felony fleeing right. and eluding, which that's the statute that we're talking about, where, hey, it can be a situation where the officer is standing in the street and tells you to stop and they flee, and that's still fleeing and eluding. Or the officer's in a vehicle and everyone's going 100 miles right. an hour, and it doesn't matter whether they're in uniform because the person going 100 miles an hour can't see them anyway.
Right. And that's the bigger point before that. Just to get on my soapbox and defend myself and Noah, because we got it right, is those officers in the car, one testified and one did not.
Right.
Because the female driver stayed with the department. The male passenger, who was the training was the trainee. She was the training officer. He was the trainee. He ended up leaving the department, going to Garden City Police Department, I believe. And then was out of the state. We couldn't get him in. But we had that field training, the FTO, the training officer, the female on the stand. And we asked her, is this your body camera? Yes. We also played his body camera and said, is that his body camera? Is it accurate to what you were seeing? And she said, yes. We played both body cameras and said, are you on the camera? Is he on the camera? Is that him getting out of the car? Is that you getting out of the car? And she said, yes. So it is in the transcript who these people are. And had the ADA, who's arguing the case, saw that and read that in the transcript, he would have said, well, on page whatever, this witness is asked by the state, are you the driver of the vehicle and who is the passenger? And these are the people we can see on the body worn camera.
Right. And one of the justices was either Justice LeGros or Justice Colvin specifically asked, like, there's only one female officer there, right? That's the one that's yes. on the stand. Like, the jury could see that she's a female officer, right? And couldn't get a yes answer right. out of the prosecutor at oral argument. I was so angry after watching this oral argument. Because again, it's not that hard to pick up the telephone. If no. you don't know, ask. And I'm just stunned by it. In any case, we end up in this situation where you're having justices say things like, well, you know, and means something.
That's, they came out with your question from the beginning. What is your best argument that, let's just say, that the state did not ask the question or prove that the officer in the vehicle chasing Jerry Chambers was in uniform with a badge on her chest? What's your best argument that that doesn't matter? Well, the other thing that Noah and I knew at the time was there's a number of cases on point, and there was a case that specifically said you don't have to prove that every time, right? The reason you have to prove that an officer is in uniform is so that you can show the defendant knew he was running from a police officer. And what the appellate court said, Georgia Court of Appeals said, was, listen, when somebody's fleeing at 100 miles an hour in a car at night, they can't see what the driver of the other car is wearing. So why the hell would it matter? What matters is the other person was driving a police car with blue lights.
Well, right, but you prove both anyway. And this is where I get so angry, because we are getting into this esoteric ether where we're going to talk about definitions of words, and the way the opinion reads is, well, the statute says, and so you have to prove both. It's like, but you did. And the reason right. that the justices didn't know that was because the person making the argument didn't say it. Right. It's not that it's not in the record. And, you know, Justice LeGros actually went through in great detail about it, but it is incumbent upon the advocate to bring right. it to the court's attention.
He did not identify the officer in video because he didn't try to beforehand. He did not cite the case
right.
from the Court of Appeals, and he did not cite the cases beyond that. That even if you want to have this legal debate about what and means, what are you taught in day one of law school when you draft an indictment? And if you draft an indictment that says, I beat and stabbed you, what have I just done?
It's just, so rather than being conjunctive, which is, you know, the and usually is a conjunctive, in the legal world, it's disjunctive. You can prove either and still be sufficient. For the jury.
I have to explain this to juries all the time. I indict people with and, right? you beat and stab somebody. And common knowledge, jury goes, well, you got to prove to me that he beat and stabbed this person. I'm like, hold on. The law is weird and it makes absolutely no sense. When we draft an indictment and we charge somebody with a crime, you have to put them on notice with what they were charged with. And so if I say you beat and stabbed the person, they jump up before trial and go, which is it? You're not telling me what I did. Did I beat and stab him? Because and means or, which is this bizarre thing that when you put and in, it means beat or stab. So you have to read it as beat or stab. And so
again, common sense may not be applicable in the legal realm.
And so whenever you see and to it, the simple way to describe it without going into this weird debate is whenever you see and you're a lawyer, it actually means or. And so when the statute says an officer in an appropriately marked vehicle and in a uniform, as lawyers, we read that as in an appropriately marked vehicle or in uniform.
Right. And
that was really long and convoluted. You should probably cut that shit out.
No, we can't because it's the law. But I think it is really very important for the jury's, from the jury listeners, to take away from this some very basic things, which are no matter how much work, how much emotion that you put in on the front end, how some people on some remote place in some little courtroom somewhere else can say, hey, you didn't prove and so, oh, murderer goes free.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing is the common sense as the person who is not a lawyer. You know, if I were not an attorney, I were just a citizen of this community, I would look at this and go, you're telling me that this violent gang member who has committed shootings, who has, you know, refused to abide by the law, who has been a pure terror to this community, is given a new trial and being set free because what you're telling me as is that him not being able to see an officer's uniform at night at 100 miles an hour led him to believe that he didn't know he was running from police, that the blue lights and sirens after he just shot multiple people were not enough notice to him that he was running from a police officer. And that's what Justice Namias asked. He was like, well, I think it was Namias or it could have been Peterson, asked, well, what if somebody gets out of a car and they're not wearing a uniform? It might not be a police officer and you're a woman on the side of the road and this person gets out and they're wearing, you know, like overalls and nothing under in it. It looks like they're about to start playing dueling banjos. Are you supposed to stop? I'm like, well, that's not what happened here. He shot somebody and within 4 minutes gets a car behind him with lights and sirens. So in essence, what the Supreme Court believed was that Jerry Chambers shot an individual, and at the same time he shot somebody, two random citizens stole a police car and began to chase Jerry Chambers for absolutely no reason to pull him over. So he felt like he should just keep going because maybe these aren't
and
the
go
cops.
Faster. And go faster. And hit people.
It is complete bullshit.
It is. And I feel like this is not a full system failure. I mean, and when I say go free, he's not free. I guess homicide by vehicle is still in play for him from a sentencing standpoint. But the reality is he is not being held accountable for the crimes he committed that were proven at trial. And it's not justice. It is not what we can go to the justice system for.
No, and he's not being held accountable for the crimes that a jury of this community found that he did. And that to me is a bigger issue that the hallmark of our system is the jury.
Right.
That you get a jury of your peers. And you know what? Maybe you get some good people. Maybe you get some bad people. Maybe you get some people in the middle. But those are the people that are going to make the decision as to what happens. And in this case, we did that. We gave every piece of evidence to that jury. That jury said, you know what? We live here. We've been given the law. We've been given the facts. And we believe this happened. And then 2.5, 3 years later, a group of people who have nothing to do with this community, know nothing about this case, say, you know what? Our judgment is better than that jury. And if that's the case, then why does the jury system matter?
Well, right. So there are some hallmarks of appellate work, too. And of course, I did appeals. You know, we both done our own appeals. There was a brief period where I was also the appellate attorney for the office. There are hallmarks of that as well. One of which is that essentially you give deference to that verdict. If the verdict, you know, verdict speaks the truth, you don't go behind that. The second is giving deference to the trial court. So the trial judge is the first person to pass on this question, this legal question, the straight legal question. So the factual question is put to the jury. Did you prove that these people were in uniform? They're like, yep. And then the legal question of, well, was the evidence sufficient to prove that? And the judge who was there in the courtroom passed on it, not only as the judge, but also as what they call the 13th juror.
Right.
That's part of the motion for new trial practice. And he's like, yep. And somehow those hallmarks, those requirements that an appellate court give deference to the jury and give deference to the trial judge have been thrown out the window in favor of, hey, and means and.
Yeah, it just
which has never meant in, like, ever.
And there was a case on point that said, hey, this is all you have to prove. And now they're going to go, you know what, we disagree. We're going to move the goalpost. You actually did everything you were supposed to do in this trial. You did it right. But we're going to come back and go, you know what, we disagree with the law we told you was the law. We're going to just change it now.
And why this case? Of all cases where you're going to just do some random shit, why this one?
Right.
Where people are dead. It takes my breath away. Just the way they just don't care. They just don't care. And you know what they say, justice is blind, but blind does not mean ignoring facts. I'm not over this. I'm not going to be over it for a while. But thank you for coming to talk about it. Is there anything else you think we need to talk about with this one?
Oh, I'm sure there is. it's been, I'm out of beer. So I don't think there's anything else we need to talk about.
Well, I am really grateful that you were willing to come and talk to me about this. I know that there are other cases we need to talk about. We've been talking off of the podcast about things to do. We're going to do it at some point. But this case is hot in my head right now. And I want to make sure that we actually speak to what happened here. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you. How the appellate prosecutor and the court's majority could ignore the video evidence in this case is simply mind-boggling. But giving no meaning to the findings of the jury and the trial court, negating decades of legal interpretation, that is injustice. And it hurts us all.